Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jeffries, and this is a bookin' brought to you by Explore Booksellers, Aspen, Colorado's trusted community bookstore. Wherever you are in the world, it is always good to explore. My guest today is John Simmons, short fiction award-winning author Janice Obohosky. Her fiction has appeared in Gettysburg Review, Crazy Horse, Alaska Quarterly Review, Story, and many more venues. Her new book is The Woods, a collection of short stories which is published by our friends at University of Iowa Press. Janice, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Jason. This is great fun.
It's an honor to have you here. And first, Janice, you live in Middlebury, Vermont. Before I took this job in Aspen here, I almost moved to Middlebury, Vermont, just as I was being recruited for a job there. I was just never able to get there because of blizzards and such. And I felt like I wasn't going to be able to find a place to live, etc. I have since interviewed three authors from Middlebury, Vermont, including you. The other two being Megan Mayhew Bergman and Chris Bojalian. Can you tell me about Middlebury and the surrounding environs and why there are so many writers there?
I mean, it's a good question. So Middlebury has Middlebury College at the center of it. And if you go up the mountain, that's where Bread Loaf Writers Conference has been held for, I think we're going on about 100 years. So there is a tradition of writers coming to Vermont or coming to this area. Chris, actually, Bojalian and I are going to do an event together in about a week, which was set up by the Vermont Bookshop, the Vermont Bookstore. So, and Megan teaches at the college, and we know each other from, you know, just being around the same area. It's pretty and charming here. It's a pretty little campus town, pretty little college town. So I don't know why we have so many writers, though.
Well, that's fantastic. And that sounds like a great event that you have coming up with Chris. Has he gotten his voice back yet? Last time I spoke with him, he had lost his voice for like 2 years or something like that.
Oh, right. Because of long COVID, right?
Yeah.
I think he's okay, but he sounds hoarse from what I can tell. He seems though high energy. I mean, he's traveling and he's being so good about helping promote the event. I mean, he's just being a gem. So he seems in good spirits.
Great. Yeah. He's so high energy. It doesn't matter, but he described his voice to me as sounding like Grandpa Simpson. So that was a lot of fun. Well, let's now dive into this excellent collection, The Woods. We're going to cover the first two stories here. The first one is called The Cat. And my first question, Janice, is, does this book take place in Middlebury?
It takes place in a fictionalized Middlebury. I took a lot of liberties. So if I imagine something, that's fair game in my mind. I don't always have to be faithful to the town or the people in it. So it's that story takes place in a fictionalized East Middlebury, which is where I live. Which is very woodsy and small, and but I feel freedom to take license wherever I want, or to sort of reimagine as I see fit.
Yeah, and to expand on this question a little bit, what are the challenges of writing a collection of short stories based on a very small town where you just happen to live and work?
The challenges are, you know, most of this I've invented, especially the characters, but the setting is very accurate. And so at points, people have told me that they've been hunting for themselves or for other people in the collection. I think one of the things I thought about was that if I ever was basing anything on someone or something, that I was not taking, you know, shots at that person or doing anything unkind. That's not my instinct. And but I'm now learning that people are sort of hunting for information. I had a really funny moment where somebody said to me, they described a scene as the scene on Stephen DiNadio's porch, there is a scene that takes place on a professor's porch that is Stephen Donadio's. And I thought it's so funny what people recognize, the tiny things that they see that I've sort of taken.
Yeah, that is funny. Thank you so much, Janice. Are there really tons of feral cats roaming Middlebury? And if so, why?
There are not tons of feral cats roaming Middlebury. This actually, the story, the cat took place in part because I realized I understood so little about the environment in which I lived, which this is the smallest place I've ever lived. And someone told me that there were feral cats living in the abandoned quarries nearby. And I assumed that that was true. And then I had this cat that was coming around to my apartment. And I thought, oh, it's one of the cats, feral cats that lives in an abandoned quarry. And then another friend said to me, Janice, that cat's not feral. If it wants to sit and be pet, it actually, it's probably been abandoned or, you know, left behind. And I thought, I don't know anything. There are not, that it was just a misinformation or me trying to make sense of my environment, but I wasn't right in that case, or I'd been given the wrong information.
Right. Well, thank you so much, Janice. You write about the town in your book that the beauty is dense, disordered, unruly, that there is something in the mix of the highfalutin and the feral that invites thoughts of the spectral. Can you unpack that statement for us?
Sure. I think that there's something about, I live in a tiny little neighborhood that is abut the Green Mountain National Forest, which is expansive. And I live at the base of a mountain. There's something about nature being so omnipresent and a kind of wildness that I see that's both beautiful, but a little bit frightening even at points, because it's so large. I mean, I've gotten lost in these woods. I spent 3 hours in them. I know, unable to get out. And I ended up in like on some hog farm in a town over, and this farmer had to help me get back. I also think there's something about how much history there is in this town. There are a lot of ghost stories, just even local ghost stories. I live on a paved road, but at the edge of a dirt road. And at the edge of that dirt road, there's another woman who's doing a local podcast about ghost stories in Middlebury. And I thought, it's not coincidence. There's five of us on this tiny road. And the idea that two of us are thinking about ghosts, it feels that there is something a tiny bit haunted about being surrounded by so much woods and, you know, these old cemeteries up the mountain six generations back.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Janice, I'm glad you found your way out of the woods.
thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Listeners, we are going to take a short break here to listen to a word from our sponsors, and then I will be right back with Janice Obahowski. The Book and Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin, Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores. I'm back with Janice Obahowski, author of The Woods, which is published by our friends at University of Iowa Press. Back to the first story in this collection, The Cat, for a moment. You write in this story of a moment where the protagonist had become confused about what was her life and what was story. And I'm hoping that you can unpack this for our listeners. Is this a meta moment, or is this something that happens often to you?
I think that it's a moment in which the character, and I do feel affinity for her, gets lost in her own head. You know, she's something that I think about is the way that we, all of us, tell ourselves stories to make sense of our lives. I mean, we impart narrative to our days. Mm-hmm. And so I have this character teaching fiction. She's teaching certain stories and she's thinking about those stories and she's getting sort of tangled up in what she remembers of those stories versus the story she tells herself about her own life. And yes, I can be a little bit prone to that. So yeah. that was what was on my mind when I was writing it.
Absolutely. One more question about this story, and then we will move on to the next. There is a moment when summer is ending in the story, and all that the protagonist had imagined for herself, the things that she would do over the summer, all of these things were a bust. Can you mm-hmm. talk about the nature of time relative to this moment, especially as a creative person, and how these things happen?
Well, you know, one of the things I think happens is there's that disjunct between what we imagine we can accomplish versus mm-hmm. what we can actually accomplish. And especially if you're living the life of an academic where you feel like teaching has to be the primary activity for months at a time, and you only have these shorter months, say in the summer over the holidays, to get that kind of work done, you put so much pressure on yourself. And so the way time is moving there, she's thinking so much about what she should be doing that she's not getting done what she needs to be getting done. Time moves in a sort of tricky fashion in that story. I'm sort of moving through months. I'll go through time very quickly and then slow down for certain scenes, which interests me. I mean, I sort of love writing that does that. I'm still experimenting with it. Again, I wanted the sense of something where time could be expansive or quick, depending on how much she's in her own head, right? That idea of how we can sort of reimagine time, even where an hour could go by and, you know, take 5 hours in our heads because it's hard or something to get through it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I'm very familiar with this concept. Thank you so much, Janice. Let's move on to the second story in this collection, which is called The Orums. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Thank you. So first, this story opens with a set of directions. Can you tell us how receiving or providing directions to somewhere may differ in a small town from, say, a large city like Los Angeles?
Sure. Actually, you know, I went to grad school in Southern California, so I have a lot of feelings about the difference between Los Angeles and where I live now.
Yes.
Small, especially where I live in this part of New England, it can be a little bit insular. So there's a thought that they might not give you the directions if they think you're not from around here, or they might be really terse about it. Mm. The notion of who's an insider versus an outsider in this little area, it feels acute to me at points. Mm-hmm. In LA, actually, I find that people are very chatty. So it would be easy. You know, people would, they tell you four different ways to get somewhere, telling you all the freeways you could use. But here, you know, somebody might not help you, or they might, in as I do it in the story, be very direct, go this way. But there's a real name to the road, and that's not the actual, you know, whatever you see as a street sign, that we insiders know that that's not the real name, or we have a sense of history that says you should not think about this as a Green Mountain Road. You should think about this as the road that the Orums first were driving themselves, you know, over 100 years ago. Mm. So I also wanted in that story to be using a plural kind of omniscience, a we. So there's a kind of directive in that as well. We understand things. We'll tell you how they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much, Janice. Let's now talk about the poet. Who is the poet, and what type of weight does he hold in the town in this story?
Sure. So there's a poet who goes unnamed in the story. He is perhaps based upon Robert Frost. perhaps. So where I live, there, everyone has Frost stories. Mm-hmm. And some of them are very charming. I actually went to a historical society meeting in Ripton, which is up the mountain from where I live. And a woman named Hilda Billings, who was 98, was giving the talk, and she was the last general postmaster in Ripton because they don't have actually a post. They have to get their mail going down the mountain now. Mm-hmm. But she and her mother, and I think even her grandmother, had been the postmasters, and Frost used to hang out with them in the house where they lived and gossip with them. And it was all so sweet and charming. And he actually brought up the idea they had to put wanted posters, FBI most wanted posters, in their house because that's where the post office was. Mm-hmm. And Frost said, put them on the back door where no one has to see them. So there's a very charming sense of Frost being kind and a gossip in a charming way, and also being part of the landscape. Everyone sort of has their stories. But I've also heard stories about him behaving really badly. Mm. Something I put in there is based upon something I heard at Breadloaf, that he didn't like a reading that was going on during Breadloaf. And so he threw a lit cigarette into a trash can and yelled fire so that everyone would leave. Mm-hmm. Perhaps apocryphal, but I was thinking about, I've heard enough of these stories to hear that Frost was probably badly behaved at points. And I was thinking about how someone could be both charming and kind and badly behaved. I was also thinking about how an artist who's badly behaved might have different, that we might give that person license to be bad in ways that we wouldn't for somebody else. I've pitted the poet against these two brothers that I refer to as the Orams in this story. Mm-hmm. And they get into all sorts of trouble. So in some ways, I'm thinking in that story about what is bad behavior? What do we allow? What can we do about it if we don't like it?
Yeah. Do you think, just as an aside, do you think that Robert Frost's rumored bad behavior would have been more accepted in his lifetime than in our current moment in 2023?
I think it would have been much more accepted 50 years ago than now. Yeah.
I believe so too. Yeah, a lot of those stories remind me of when I went to the University of South Carolina. There were a lot of kind of apocryphal James Dickey stories. He was
on. Oh, really?
There. Yeah.
Yeah.
They sound very similar. I realized when I was thinking of moving to Middlebury, I was sort of focused on Robert Frost personally, when I should have been focused on Janice Obuhowski and Megan Mayhew Bergman and Chris Bojalian. Do you feel like this is kind of the norm, that Robert Frost still holds a lot of gravity in that area? Or do you feel like people have kind of recentered in the present day?
I'll tell you, my neighbor is 84, but he'll tell stories about serving Frost when he was a teenager and he was a waiter at the inn down the street where I live. When I went to that historical talk that I mentioned, somebody brought the sleigh bells that Frost had used for his sleigh up in Ripton and shook them in the town meeting hall where the meeting took place. Someone else recited a Frost poem. Mm. So Frost does still have a hold on the town, sort of as he's imagined. That's the big difference. He's how he's remembered, how people still think fondly of him. Mm-hmm. Even though there's that story about how he got Truman Capote fired after Truman Capote tried to leave one of Frost's readings up the mountain. So I know. so I would say that Frost is still part of the collective imagination of this town. But, Chris, sure. I mean, people are very excited and thrilled that he's around town as well. He's always out on his bike, and people are saying hello, from what I can see, or notice when he's around. So we're both acknowledging our past, but in the contemporary moment too.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Janice. Back to the story, the Orams. There is a line in the story along the lines of, people are decent, or at least they believe they are, which most of the time is enough. And my question for you, Janice, is it enough? In other words, is it possible to believe something into a capital T truth?
Whew. No, I think, again, this has to do with what we imagine for ourselves. Mm. So akin to the cat this is saying we think that we're decent most of the time, but also we don't know what to do with bad behavior when we're faced with it. We don't know how to correct it. We don't know how to take action against it, that we're actually very limited. And if we're that limited, are we in fact decent? That's the question I think the text is asking. Mm-hmm. Because in the story, those two brothers get into more and more trouble and it's escalating and the town has no answer. To my mind, that story is a little bit about moral or even ethical woe, that we're limited. Mm-hmm. We are sort of fragile and not necessarily always as good as we think we are, mm-hmm. or not as capable of doing good, which is probably a different thing than sort of just wishing that things were good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Janice. Earlier, in our first question of this interview, mm-hmm. we talked a little bit about the Vermont Bookshop via your upcoming event with Chris. Would you like to take a moment to talk about the Vermont Bookshop and what this store means to the community there?
I think it's at the center of the community. We have this tiny little main street and there's all these shops lining it, and the shops tend to come and go. They, mm-hmm. Things don't always succeed in the town. Mm-hmm. But the bookshop feels like an anchor. The bookshop has, and it toughed out the pandemic. And, you know, I was just shopping there over the holidays. They have what they call, it's Middlebury. So they have what they call the midnight stroll, so that you can shop at night right before the holidays. And it was so festive in that bookshop. You know, people are just coming and going. And Becky, the owner, is really smart. She's really kind. She's helped set up this event for me. She has talked with me about the book. She's read parts of the book. She's made sure that my book is up front in the store so that, you know, it gets a little bit more visibility. Mm-hmm. I think it might go hand in hand with having a town where it's a college town. There's a lot of smart people around, but it's also separate from the college. And in that sense, I think she's doing great work for the community, you know, the readers.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. I always like to talk about bookstores as we are a podcast in and of a bookstore here. Well, Janice, finally, we have only covered two stories here, and I have found in my 4 years of doing this podcast that I oftentimes find more to talk about in a short story than I do in a novel, which makes it incredibly difficult to talk about a whole short story yeah. collection without the podcast running into several hours. But can you talk for a moment about the difference between a short story and a novel, and what besides the length of the story is the difference between the two mediums?
Sure. You know, when I was a fiction editor at the New England Review, I fielded this question a lot because people would submit novel excerpts and they would say, well, and the idea was always if the novel excerpt is self-contained, and everyone would claim that their novel excerpt was self-contained. And frankly, the truth is, if you're thinking about the text as a kind of argument, a novel chapter, either the first chapter is setting you up for information to come, and every chapter before the ending is both recalling the information that came before and setting you up for information that will happen. So I think of it as if you were to take your hands and put them in different directions, it's always the vectors are before and after in a novel chapter especially. So not self-contained, almost never. But a short story, everything has to come together. It has to knit together. There's a kind of containment, a self-containment in the short story that is different than a chapter in a novel, but also the idea that a story has to feel fuller than a novel. It's a sort of sleight of hand, actually, as I think of it. You have 5,000 to 8,000 words, and somehow it has to feel rich enough to be satisfying as a literary experience. So you're thinking differently than you're thinking in the novel, where you have a lot of room to establish things and you're not so worried always about the pacing. The short story feels to me like it has less room for a kind of expansiveness. You need to be careful, or you need to create that expansion through what the reader can imagine, as opposed to you know, you can't have five pages of setting in a story. you have to make sure that everything is essential, and that everything is in support of whatever thematically or story-wise you're trying to accomplish.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Janice, and thank you for writing this extraordinary collection. Listeners,
thank you.
I've been speaking with Janice Obohosky, author of The Woods, which is published by our friends at the University of Iowa Press. Janice, thank you so much for joining me.
Jason, thank you. This is delightful. I was glad to do it.
Once again, I would like to thank Janice Obohosky for joining me. Copies of The Woods can be ordered from www.explorebooksellers.com with free shipping for members of Explore More Plus. I would also like to thank our sponsor, Libro FM Audiobooks. Please navigate over to libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's B-O-O-K-I-N, in the promo code space to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been Bookin'.